Ladies and gentlemen, would you please rise for the arrival of His Excellency, the Right Honourable David Johnston, Governor General of Canada, and Heather Munro Bloom, Principal and Vice Chancellor of McGill University. You may now sit. Welcome, Your Excellency. Welcome, Principal Munro Bloom. Monsieur, Madame, ladies and gentlemen, good evening. Je suis Antonia Maioni, directrice de l'Institut d'études canadiennes de l'Université McGill. Il me fait un très grand plaisir de vous souhaiter la bienvenue à la 16e conférence annuelle de l'Institut des études canadiennes de l'Université McGill, qui se concentre cette année sur les relations canado-américaines. Cette année, on a mis l'emphase sur cette relation bilatérale qui est sans doute la plus importante et la plus durable au monde, et de la revoir sous l'œil de conversations éclairées et dynamiques entre Canadiens et Américains sur les vrais fondements de cette réalité remarquable. The McGill Institute for the Study of Canada's annual conference, this year on Canada-US relations, is being sponsored by many generous governments and organizations, including the Charles and Andrea Bronfman Philanthropies, Foreign Affairs International Trade Canada, the American Embassy, the Donner Canadian Foundation, Ogilvy Renault, the Institute for Research on Public Policy, Bell Canada, the Gazette, the National Post, CARIM, the CIC Canadian International Council, and many academic sponsors, including McGill University's Dean of Arts, the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, and the Johnson Shoyama Graduate School of Public Policy at the University of Saskatchewan. I underline these partners just to give you an idea of the wealth of interest, but also of spirit of partnership and giving the interest in this conference and in all of you being here. I want to particularly thank the conference co-chair, Eileen MacDonald, for the fabulous lineup of conference speakers and his assiduous travel, but also work throughout the year. The biggest challenge for us, and even more important from an academic point of view, was to try to parse the Canada-US relationship. Its sheer magnitude, complexity, and endurance practically makes the idea of a two-day conference absurd. But we have persevered and happily prevailed, included in this year's conference conversations will be ones on diplomatic relationships, on economics, trade, and innovation, on energy and sustainability, on our subnational relationships that are so important between states and provinces, and the very tenor of public opinion between Canadians and Americans. And we are especially excited about the format of this year's conference, which will feature key decision makers and stakeholders in conversation with one another. And so the goal is to bring alive the relationship between the two countries and the key factors in managing the day-to-day affairs that goes along with that. We'll also, here we go, use the latest technology to have virtual interviews with speakers from Canada and the United States. We'll be streaming the conference live, and we have off-site partners. This conference, therefore, can be viewed live from anywhere in the world, but you are privileged to be here with us this evening. I'd also like to point out that we'll have an off-site moderator, Adam DeFala, who is here in the room. We'll be able to connect with those off-site locations, and we'll ask you, as members of the audience, your opinions about the day's proceedings. All of these discussions will be streamed live and videotaped, so be sure to visit Adam during the breaks. And despite all the odds of putting together such an ambitious event, and despite the very busy week unfolding in Ottawa as we speak, the conference staff and organizers have ensured an exciting and thought-provoking event. Not only have we been fortunate to have with us an inspiring number of speakers, we also have our participants and in our audience, leaders, past, present, and future, from every walk of life, business, law, politics, journalism, academia, including the many, many students from McGill and beyond the Roddick Gates. So welcome to you all, and thank you. J'aimerais maintenant demander à mon collègue au département de sciences politiques et le doyen de la Faculté des Arts, le professeur Christopher Manfredi, de vous adresser la parole comme maître de cérémonie pour ce soir. Monsieur le doyen.
Merci beaucoup, Antonia. Je suis très fier, comme doyen de la Faculté des Arts, de vous souhaiter la bienvenue à cette conférence de l'Institut d'études canadiennes de McGill. I want to congratulate both Professor Maione and Ellian MacDonald for putting together such a terrific conference. It brings honor both to the Faculty of Arts and to McGill University, and I think it demonstrates the convening power of the faculty and the university to bring together so many terrific people on such an important topic. My job this evening and tomorrow is to act as Master of Ceremonies, so you don't get to hear a speech from the Dean, for which you should be very thankful. My first task is, of course, the very important one of reminding you to put your cell phones on vibrate mode. That is, of course, very critical. As Antonia said, the conference is being, or McGill and both CPAC are filming the proceedings, and the conference is being streamed live. I'm going to not waste very much more of your time and to get into our formal proceedings very quickly by introducing Mr. Alex Patterson, who will introduce our opening speaker. Alex Patterson is a retired senior partner at the Montreal Law Office of Borden, Ladner, Gervais. He was admitted to the Quebec Bar in 1957, started his professional career with McMaster Meehan, was chairman of McGill University from 1990 to 94, and chancellor of Bishop's University from 1995 to 2005. Monsieur Patterson est reconnu comme l'un des meilleurs plaideurs au Québec et a été nommé membre à la fois de l'Ordre du Canada et de l'Ordre du Québec. Il assume désormais, conjointement avec M. Charles Bronfman, la coprésidence du Conseil d'administration de l'Institut d'études canadiennes de McGill. Mr. Patterson.
Madam Principal. Your Excellency, I guess it should be Your Excellency, Madam Principal, Madam Director. It is a huge privilege and honor to introduce the Governor General on his first visit back to McGill. It's a difficult task. How do you introduce somebody with a 9-page curriculum vitae whose every success has been on the front page of every newspaper in Canada, on every television station, all during and before his inauguration and since? So I am starting on the assumption you've read all of that. You know all of that, and I'm not going to take you through very much of it. I'm going to tell you things that I think you don't know. Don't worry. But you should know that David Johnson was educated at Harvard, Cambridge, and then came back to Canada to the University of Queen's. When he graduated, he took a position as a professor, first at Queen's, then at Toronto in the Faculty of Law, and from there, he was invited to be the dean of Western University. And from Western University, at a very tender age, with 6 girls to look after, one his wonderful wife, Her Excellency, and his 5 daughters, he was invited by McGill to leave the comforts and peace of London, Ontario, and come and live in Quebec. And this shows the first huge characteristic of David Johnson, courage. Can you imagine in 1976, when the Parti Québécois had just been elected, in 1979, 1 year before the referendum, accepting a job, having been educated entirely in the English-speaking world, in Quebec. But he did. It didn't deter him at all. And were we lucky? And did it give us a shot in the arm? I mean, people were leaving by the thousands. And that this young, brilliant professor would put his stake in the ground in Quebec and McGill and make his career here was a huge shot in the arm to us and to McGill, as it should have been, as it turned out. He finished those 15 years, went on for 4 more as a professor, and then was invited to go to the University of Waterloo, where he was again the president, this time for about 13 years. And he's had an amazing career, published at least 20 books, many articles, chaired commissions nationally in national political issues, in business, in securities law, which is his specialty, and there's just too much to go over, and I don't think he or you would need to hear all that. But I think it's important to underline that when he went to Waterloo, he did the same kind of things as he did at McGill. Waterloo was a good university. Waterloo was very into entrepreneurial things, high-tech things and everything. But it was not an international university of the type of Toronto or McGill. But it was soon to become one under David Johnson. And a school of architecture, a beautiful building was bought with money that he raised. An international studies department was opened. This goes on and on and on of the impact he made. And again, it took some courage to go from principal of McGill to principal of Waterloo, but his courage and his adventuresome made it work. He has an extraordinary family. When he was at McGill, we would be invited to his house on Sunnyside after a convocation, and you would meet Elizabeth Bondar, the recent astronaut, Pierre Elliott Trudeau, and nobody went for that. He went to meet his five daughters. And his five daughters served the meals, entertained the guests, and had a flair together with their mother that made the whole business such a huge joy to us all. And, of course, he took that act to Waterloo. Now, the girls were older by then, and when he was appointed Governor General, I said to my wife, Joni, what's he going to do? I mean, how's he going to replace the five daughters? Seven grandchildren. So now when you go to Rideau Hall, you still get the girls. There's 12 of them now, but it's this ability to keep his family together in whatever he's doing and to show, what an example, to show. I mean, he has five daughters. They're all professionals. They've all gone through university. And now he's got these seven wonderful grandchildren, and that is much of what David Johnson is. I have to tell you that as much as he has a very high academic standing, he's also known as quite an athlete, a skier, a runner, football. But probably his highest moment of success was in hockey at Harvard. Played for the Harvard team. He became a superstar for Harvard in their Hall of Fame. And again, it was his determination. If the puck was coming at the net and David's hands were otherwise occupied, it was his mouth and his teeth that stopped the puck. And the coach finally said to him, look, Johnson, you're too important to this team. Go into the corner and get the puck, but come out with your teeth. His daughter, 20, 25 years later, played for the same team. Wasn't quite as ready to put her teeth in the way of the puck, but she developed such a slap shot that she once broke her father's thumb on the rink. Now, many fathers would get pretty, frankly, pissed off by that. David was very proud that his daughter had developed such an extraordinary slap shot. Apart from the athletics, I can't think of personalities and their excellencies and the family to be our country's really model. Perhaps not a lot of political power, but by God, they set an example for us all, and by visiting across the country continuously, set an example for the East, the West, the North, the South, and all parts of the Canadian culture. Let me finish with an example of how they function so well. There is a program in the townships called the Adaptive Ski Program, and there's a program in the military called Soldier On. And Soldier On is for veterans that come back and have lost, basically amputees, although it can be other things. And Soldier On teaches the veterans how to ski. And very quickly, when David Johnson became Governor General, I said, would you consider coming, because they're coming on the 24th this year of January. I know the schedule. I thought it's impossible. Within a week, I started getting calls from Soldier On, from the Department of Defense, from the Governor General's office. And to my delight, on August the 24th, the Johnsons showed up. Now, Sharon showed up first. She didn't go around the room shaking hands. She went around the room practically on her hands and knees, looking at the processes, finding out how they'd lost their limb, finding out what they were trying to do to rehabilitate, finding out what their ambitions, their families were. It was a class act. And then His Excellency arrived. And he did what their excellencies do, but in a very low-key way, threatening no one, making everybody feel good and important in what they'd been doing. And then the RCMP said, he's going to ski with you, isn't he? And I said, I hope so. And they said, well, now's the time. And he was dressed like he's dressed today. I said, how are we going to do this? So you take him in a little room, and my God, the pink boots come out and everything, and they get him dressed. And we go out, and I said to the two RCMP guys behind us, when we get to the top, you watch me. When we go down the hill, you watch him. Because he's a great skier, but I'm a little wobbly getting off. We get to the top of the hill, and to my amazement, out of my left eye, I see the Governor General doing cartwheels over the top of the hill with his skis coming off. I blame no one for this, but that's what happened. The RCMP pole vaulted over me, straightened up the Governor General. He took off down the hill. I followed, but nowhere near at his speed. So he got there first. He was the first one to speak to the people at the bottom of the hill, who, of course, asked him what went on at the top of the hill. Well, he said, everything seemed to be going fine until Mr. Patterson pushed me off the chairlift. That's competition. When, and I'll close with this, when David Johnson was on the stage at Place des Arts for his last convocation as principal, I read him this poem, which I'm not going to read again, but entitled, And That's Why You're the Principal, and I Am Just the Chair. But, Your Excellency, I've updated it with just 8 short lines. I'm proud to be with you again. Now you're His Excellency. The first name in who's who, while I've become who's he. We salute you, Your Excellency. You're a model for us all. Welcome back to Old McGill. Have fun at Rideau Hall.
You have just witnessed a labor of love. Only Alec could give an introduction of that kind. Thank you so much, Alec. I'm home. How wonderful it is to be with old friends. Jean, Charles here, Greta, Heather, Alec, Dick, so many other great friends back here home. Principal, Provost, Ambassador, Emeritus Chancellors, current and past co-chairs and director of the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada, friends and colleagues, I must tell you I was a little nervous when I accepted this because it's coming back home. And then when Antonio was speaking a moment ago, she made reference to the inspiring speakers that you're going to hear. And I recollected that when we were organizing this, I was told, well, you don't really have to speak very long. Just give a short, inspiring, and warm message. And it brought back Heather, I think it was the second month at McGill, and we had the first of 15 consecutive years of budget cuts, and we sat down and decided what we could do. Only in Quebec at that time, 1979, did Quebec Hydro have an incentive, both capital and operating, to replace any of the appliances in the institution which didn't use electricity and convert to electricity. So the brainwave was that we'd replace all the paper hand drying machines in the washrooms of the university with electronic hand dryers. Lo and behold, we issued the instruction. It was carried out within a matter of days. And out I went to the McConnell Engineering Building to view this remarkable act of leadership. And lo and behold, there was a brand new electric hand drying machine on the wall in the men's washroom. But already day one, some graffiti had been inscribed in the white paint just above the depressor button. And the graffiti said, "Press this button for a short, warm, inspiring message from your principal." I'm now giving that story in French, and I'll tell you this is a question of whether you've mastered the nuances in French to be able to carry that off. And I should have done it just today as a today. But I should say when I was asked to do this, I was really so thrilled for many, many reasons. First of all, I'm simply delighted to be back at the Institute for the Study of Canada among so many friends and former colleagues. It was my privilege during my time as principal of this blessed institution, McGill, to have played a role in establishing this institute in the mid-1990s, Charles's wonderful vision, and we all cheered him on to carry it off. The aim was and remains today to study and stimulate understanding on the past, present, and future of this great and blessed country, Canada, and in so doing to make it better. That, of course, is the motto of the Order of Canada. They desire a better country. As subjects go, it's an ambitious one. Lord Tweedsmuir, John Buchan, one of my predecessors, remarked on this when he was appointed in 1935. Canada, he said, is a biggish job. Let me take this opportunity to applaud the students, faculty, and supporters of this institute for the wonderful work in advancing our understanding of Canada and of our place in the world. And now to the theme of my remarks today, Canada's position as a global leader in learning and innovation. It's also a biggish topic, and another reason why I'm so glad to be here today. Depuis mon installation comme gouverneur général, je parle d'une nation avertie et bienveillante. Je me suis inspiré des découvertes de Samuel de Champlain, ce grand explorateur qui a dressé la cartographie de six de nos provinces actuelles et de cinq États américains. Il a également été le premier gouverneur de ce que nous appelons maintenant le Canada. Champlain est un personnage qui est mal compris. Les livres d'histoire ont fait de lui un héros de Canada français, un conquérant et un bâtisseur d'empire. But as Pulitzer Prize-winning historian David Fisher points out in his recent book, Champlain's Dream, Champlain was a true dreamer who envisaged a new order in a new world. Having seen the violent religious wars and upheavals of 16th century Europe, Champlain dedicated his life to building a society based on the rule of law, diversity, tolerance, inclusiveness, and peace. These were the necessary preconditions to the discoveries and pioneering settlements, the innovations, if you will, of the New World. To give just one example, respect for justice and the rule of law gave Champlain the legitimacy to lead in conditions of extreme hardship and instability. In fact, there was a conspiracy to murder Champlain early in Quebec. He apprehended the conspirators just hours before they were to carry out the deed. And rather than executing him immediately, as was the custom in a military zone, he organized a trial by jury, with due process convicted them. But because this was not France, he felt he could not exercise the sanction of death. So he sent them back to France for their sentence to be reviewed. And in fact, with a change of government there and Champlain out of favor, they in fact were pardoned. One example of the interesting system of justice. Where earlier settlements had failed, the fledgling colony of New France endured, thanks in part to the basic civil order, the smartness established by Champlain. Cette société était également bienveillante. Les premiers colons comprenaient le lien de dépendance qui existait entre eux. Champlain lui-même a dit que la colonie de Port-Royal n'aurait pu survivre la première idée en 1605 sans l'aide généreuse des Premières Nations locales. Au fil du temps, des immigrants sont arrivés par vagues, cultivant la terre pour pouvoir en vivre dans l'espoir d'une vie meilleure pour leurs enfants. Le résultat, en Canada, qui est une expérience de paix, de tolérance et d'inclusion, que se poursuit jusqu'à ce jour. Selon moi, la vision de Champlain est encore plus pertinente aujourd'hui qu'il y a 400 ans. Canadians have long been leaders in shaping and responding to new global realities. Think of railway building in the 19th century, or the introduction of new communication technologies in the 20th. These developments, which helped to knit our country together, grew from the interplay of creativity, collaboration, and stability made possible by good governance and respect for the rule of law. The internet, which took less than a decade to reach more than halfway around the world, and bear in mind the book, the printed work, took over 300 years to reach half the population of Western Europe, is the latest communication revolution to reshape the global context in which we live. In 2017, Canada will celebrate its 150th birthday. In fact, Montreal will celebrate its 375th birthday. And since my installation, I've been inviting Canadians to think about ways to build a smarter, more caring nation as our birthday event. The society we dream of will measure itself by how well it develops the talents of Canadians and how it uses knowledge to improve the human condition at home and around the world. So what does that mean for this remarkable institute in this remarkable university in this place at this time? First, I invite this institute and the participants here to help crystallize our vision for 2017. What are the goals and mechanisms by which we can continue to serve as a model of peace, tolerance, and inclusiveness for the entire world? How can we ensure a stable foundation from which to learn and innovate? And what are the challenges to Champlain's formula in the 21st century? Second, I wanted to speak briefly about our vision at this conference focused on Canada-U.S. relations, because in a global society, the well-being of one nation depends upon that of all the others. And in fact, we have much in common and much to learn from one another. In fact, I wager there has been no more beneficial relationship between two nations in history, at least from the Canadian viewpoint. Permettez-moi de vous en donner un petit exemple personnel. Les Canadiens ont énormément profité de la dynamique culture américaine d'apprentissage et d'innovation. Je suis moi-même un Canadien qui a étudié aux États-Unis et ont passé 4 années fantastiques à Harvard, tout comme mon unique frère a passé 4 années mémorables à Dartmouth. Plusieurs de mes filles, qui possèdent entre elles 4 diplômes de Harvard et de Dartmouth, ont grandement bénéficié de l'excellence de l'éducation postsecondaire aux États-Unis. Nombreuses sont les familles canadiennes qui ont des histoires semblables. Au Canada, nous avons travaillé très fort tout au long de notre histoire pour assurer l'égalité des chances. Les jeunes Canadiens ont un accès universel à l'éducation primaire et secondaire et ont la possibilité d'étudier dans les 2 langues officielles. Notre système scolaire public, qui fait l'envie du monde entier, est le fondement de notre société avertie et bienveillante. Nous devons nous en féliciter, tout comme nous devons chérir nos enseignants qui se font un devoir de nous inspirer, de nous encourager et de nous inciter à nous dépasser. Our challenge is to have equality of opportunity and excellence too, that great challenge of John Gardner, to see these 2 objectives, equality of opportunity and excellence, as mutually reinforcing and not mutually exclusive. On equality of opportunity, one 2017 goal might be to raise our high school graduation rate to 90%. Finland's is above 95%. Ontario has raised its rate from 68% to 81% in the last 5 years through a creative, respectful partnership with its teachers. That, in fact, is an outstanding accomplishment. a year ago when the four-year result was from 68 to 79%. There was an announcement by the Minister of Education in Ontario of this achievement in 4 years. It achieved no notice whatsoever in the National Post or the Globe and Mail, and it had seven-page, two-paragraph treatment in the Toronto Star. I stirred myself from my lethargy as a university president, and I wrote a short op-ed piece to the Globe and the National Post saying, why would you not cover something as important as that? Imagine a jurisdiction that raises a high school graduation point participation rate by 8 or 9 percentage points in 4 years. That's a remarkable accomplishment. It wasn't published. I guess if I had said something else, perhaps it might have been. But why would we take something like that for granted? These are important accomplishments that we should all be responsible for. On excellence, can we raise our aspirations to the highest level by funding MacArthur-type genius awards in Canada? Can we raise the number of Canadian Nobel Prize winners for work done in Canada to the top five in the world? We have had Nobel Prize winners, plenty of them. But in the majority of cases, they receive the Nobel Prize, sometimes for work begun in Canada, but continued in the United States, because they have gone to the places where the resources are ready, better for them to do their best work. Can we place 5 of our universities in the global top 50 and another 5 in the next 50 of international rankings? The latest Times ranking has 3 of our universities in the first 33, and of course our beloved McGill is there prominently, and 1 more in the next 50. Why don't we double that? In a globalized world, the strength of our ideas and the pace of our innovation will determine our quality of life. As in Champlain's time, our success will rest upon our respect for law, legitimacy, and pluralism, as well as our ability to collaborate. History reminds us of the importance of partnerships and developing clusters of excellence for the betterment of society. I want to illustrate the importance of collaboration with a little story from CAE in Montreal. Derek, my great friend, is there, who knows and loves CAE, having led it so well. A wonderful, wonderful Canadian story of a company that is at the leading edge in such a remarkable way in flight simulators and so much else. This is a story that Malcolm Gladwell told. You would know Malcolm as the author of Blink, Tipping Point, What the Dog Saw, etc. Imagine a Canadian at one point, 3 of his books on the New York Times bestseller list. Not one, not two, but 3. One, I think, had gone for 2.5 years at that point. Malcolm's dad is a lovely professor of civil engineering at University of Waterloo, and if ever the title civil engineer fits someone, it fit Malcolm's dad. He was giving a convocation speech at the University of Waterloo for an honor degree. Heather, it was less than 5 minutes, brought joy to the heart of poor old principals and rectors that are always concerned about the time of convocation. He gave it without a note, and Derek, it was about CAE. He said, I want to speak about something I saw at CAE 5 or 6 months ago because it taught me so much about how modern organizations must operate and how we must operate for leadership and innovation in the 21st century. He says, I was there observing a pilot and a co-pilot in a flight simulator, and they were managing the flight of a Boeing 737 or an Airbus 320, a narrow-body two-engine plane. And the event that they were dealing with was a failure of one of the two engines on takeoff just after the airplane had gotten off the runway with wheels coming up. So you couldn't put it back down on the runway after this failed engine, but you had to get it up to flight level on one engine, get it turned around, back onto the runway, and land with 150 or 170 passengers safe. He said the event took, it seemed like about 3 hours. I think it was 20 minutes. He said at the end of the 20 minutes, my shirt was wringing wet with perspiration and anxiety, and so too for these two pilots. He said there were 3 things that I observed, and I'm going to add a 4th. He says, first of all, each of those two pilots had a range of instruments in front of them with the maximum amount of information that the human mind could absorb and process in a cognitive way with a degree of reason. They were functioning at the maximum of their intellectual capacity to take in information and process it. That was one. The second was they had seamlessly to move that information from one to another because it couldn't be handled just by one of the two. They were operating this thing in partnership, and the information from one was essential to the functioning of the other and vice versa. The third, apart from the seamlessness, the third was the absence of hierarchy. You couldn't operate in a situation where the pilot was numero uno and the co-pilot would follow instructions. You had to be in a position where the co-pilot could trump the pilot for a certain type of information. A remarkable management of hierarchy in a very difficult, challenging situation. And he said that tells us so much about how we lead and how we innovate and how we operate in modern organizations. The fourth observation that comes to me was the element of trust. The importance of each of those two, trusting their ability to manage the instrumentation, trusting the flow of communication between one another, and trusting the passage of authority from one another to make this system work. Now let me end with the theme of collaboration between nations, namely our two. I remember saying to Derek one time when we were at a conference on Canada-U.S. relations, saying, I think Canada-U.S. relations is not only our single largest foreign policy issue, it's also our most important domestic policy issue. How do we manage that precious relationship, which is very good in the scheme of history and the scheme of things, to make it even better, with all of our independence and pride as a nation, but with our recognition that collaboration takes us a long way? Let me answer it this way. I often draw on Thomas Jefferson's image of a burning candle when illustrating the importance of sharing our knowledge and experiences. In fact, in this job, one is expected to produce a coat of arms, and in the coat of arms that we produced, it shows some books and a candle at the top of the crest. The books, of course, representing knowledge, and the candle, the burning candle, representing learning. And that's what it was for Jefferson. Jefferson referred to the candle of knowledge. And he said, when you light your unlit candle from my lit candle, my light is not diminished, it's enhanced. The value of knowledge also depends on its use. How can we be smarter in our caring? Canada can be a global knowledge leader, a smart nation, but our efforts need to be directed towards helping people, including the disaffected and marginalized, and that, of course, is where the caring comes in. With this in mind, let me challenge you to help shape our vision for the 150th anniversary of Confederation in 2017 and strive for a smarter, more caring nation. Let me close with the words of a great, great friend, McGill legal scholar and poet F.R. Scott. I was saying to Heather, it's like, I still get shivers up and down my spine when I come in the Roddick Gates. It'll never disappear. You love a place, and it's so much in your bones. And I talked to the ghost. I had a little conversation with Frank. Remember that wonderful line, I went to bat for Lady Chat? Remember that? Frank's shortest poem, but it was his defense of freedom of speech and creativity in literature. And on I could go. I have chats with Rutherford. I was telling Heather that I would always quote in our budget meetings Heather Rutherford, who'd say, gentlemen, since we don't have any money, we'll just have to think. Our colleagues didn't think it was very funny. And Wilder Penfield, who mapped the brain here. Imagine, you know, the mapping of the brain began here in Montreal 100 years ago, and on and on. Frank Scott, who urged us to act as citizens of the world and to live in the country of the mind. Let us also recall George Bernard Shaw's couplet, which is so apt to my remarks today, and I end with this. Some people see things as they are and wonder why. We dream of things that ought to be and ask why not. Yes, see.
Thank you very much, Your Excellency. His Excellency has agreed to take some questions. As moderator, I get to set the ground rules. I have my usual ground rules, which are that the question must be in the form of a question. There's only one question per customer. The questioning is for participants in the conference. And as moderator, I reserve the right to disallow any questions that may be inspired by current events. We also have off-site questioners, and Adam Defala is taking those. So we'll alternate between questions from our conference participants here and conference participants off-site. So I don't know where Adam is. There he is. Good. So the floor is open for questions. Adam, are there any coming in from... No questions, not yet. There are two. Yes, sir.
I was wondering,
Oh, I'm sorry. The question was about the differences between the role of the Governor General as head of state and the role of the President of the United States as head of state and head of government, and His Excellency was describing these as two very different roles. The Queen is the head of state, the Governor General is her representative in Canada, and the President of the United States is serving the dual roles of head of government and head of state. Sure. Why don't you come to the microphone?
Uncharacteristically short in that question. I suppose partly because it treads a little bit into the sphere of politics. But so what's so interesting about our Constitution is that it's largely unwritten. I was traveling with my colleague Stephen Wallace yesterday to go over to the Senate chamber to sign into effect 9 different bills. And the Governor General, as the Queen's representative, cannot enter the House of Commons. And that goes back 4 centuries, because when Charles I entered the House of Commons, it was to close down Parliament. And the monarch, or the monarch's representative, has never allowed back into the House of Commons, and only barely allowed into the Senate, and there for one purpose only, and that is to nod assent to the bills. And not to sign the bills in the Senate chamber was the custom. Everyone has to go outside, but yesterday we were allowed to sign it. And I was saying to Stephen, you know, our constitutional history is so interesting. The Americans wrote a brilliant constitution in 1789. Does it work for today? That's for them to judge. Ours has evolved over 1,000 years. Many milestones. The Magna Carta in 1215 was such an important one. When the barons met King John at Runnymede, that was a very important step in constitutional government. What I just described about Charles I was very interesting. He was beheaded for his confrontation with Parliament. I was just with Mayor Tremblay, and we had this wonderful conversation about books. And guess what he mentioned? Champlain's Dream, the book I just quoted from him and I handed out. And he said, you wouldn't have happened to read Team of Rivals about Lincoln. I said, I haven't. I loved it. Doris Goodwin, who writes it, is a wonderful colleague of mine. I said, and have you read John Ralston Saul's La Fontaine and Baldwin? He says, not yet. I says, well, I'm going to send it to you because it begins, the first page is right here, looking across the street at Chateau Ramsay, because that's where Lord Elgin came to sign into effect the Rebellion Losses Bill, which was the beginning of responsible government in Upper and Lower Canada. And we forged here in Canada in the 1840s responsible government that could not and was not happening in Europe. Was happening here. And so our unusual system of government has evolved over these years with so many historical events, not particularly planned, certainly not worked out in great detail, but it works. And when you look at it from the point of view of any other nation in the world, it works well. Not perfect. We must continue to work on it, especially this institute, but it works well.
You also have microphones if you want to ask your question at the microphone. There's a microphone there.
I know you well enough, Excellency, to know that you will have set some goals for yourself during your office of Governor General, so I'm wondering what they might be.
Aren't you wonderful? This is like Alec, a dear friend, you know, helping the old guy out. Thank you, Nora. Yes. The installation speech was entitled A Smart and Caring Nation, A Call to Service, with 3 pillars: family and children, learning and innovation, and philanthropy and volunteerism, and we're working on a strategy for each. The interesting question about that is there is a set of responsibilities for this office, which I've come to cherish, including being Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces. I'm off to the Grenadier Guards in a few moments. I happen to be colonel of that wonderful regiment. That, for me, has been a wonderful experience to see our military leaders. And then you have some discretionary areas, which I interpret as celebrating and reinforcing those values of Canada that are most important and telling the stories across the country, one to the other, so that we come to understand what a good country this is and how we make it better. We're just crafting a restatement of the mission of the Office of Governor General. And I take it, as I mentioned a moment ago, from the motto of the Order of Canada, they desire a better country. And what do we do to make this country even better, more smarter, and more caring?
Before I go to the gentleman on the right, Adam, any questions coming in from our participants off-site?
Yes, we have one question for His Excellency from Michael from Montreal. He would like to know, Why can the U.S. achieve such great wealth in their universities, but Canadian universities have more difficulty?
Well, having been a fundraiser for Harvard University since I graduated in 1963, I understand how well those great institutions do. I think in part because the private institution in the United States has been much more long-established kind of institution, and one of the many great qualities of Americans is they're very loyal to their institutions, and particularly to their alma mater, and so they benefited enormously from that. I think, secondly, there's been a great entrepreneurship in the United States, which has found its way into building the finest universities in the world. That list of 50 that I mentioned a moment ago, in most lists, there would be 40 U.S. universities on that list. In the first 10, there are typically 9 American universities. Cambridge is usually in there. I say as a Cambridge man. Oxford, the other place, sometimes is in or out. But no universities in Europe. In fact, it's hard to find one in the top 50. The Americans dominate the top 10, dominate the top 50, the top 100. But beyond the private support of institutions, their public institutions have been well supported as well. We look at the University of California system and the University of Texas system, which until the last 2 or 3 years have been well-supported state institutions. Now they're running into great difficulty at the present time. The University of Michigan is a, quote, public university, functions in many ways with the best private universities. The state of Michigan is in great, great difficulty now, but even in spite of that, they've managed. So I think there's something very, very special about Americans and their support for higher education. That we have much to learn from. That said, as we have become, as we are a public university system in Canada, in the last 20 or 30 years, during my time in university administration, I think we have become more conscious of being delighted to be public institutions supported in part by the taxpayer, but recognizing that we must do everything in our power to broaden our sources of income and to help to build quality ourselves, particularly by relying on our alumni. I say to students that graduate from Waterloo, who owns the university? Well, nobody owns the university, but you, the graduates, are its stewards. If anybody cares and loves this place, it is you, because you've given so much to it in your time and have benefited so much to it, and you should have a responsibility to leave it better. We're learning that lesson. I remember when I came to McGill in 1979, we started a campaign that had a target, Jean, of $62 million. I think it started out at 25. And when we were told the target of 25 was, couldn't reach it, impossible, it was Warren Chippendale, God love him, who went across the country dragging me with him. And we interviewed 75 McGill loyalists. We came back with a target of, I think, $62 million. Well, that was an outstanding sum. But Harvard, in 1956, which was, what, 23 years before, had a target for its campaign of $56 million. So we were about 20 or 25 years behind in a university that had not had 375 years to establish a place at Harvard, but we weren't doing badly. And we managed to achieve that target. Harvard since has gone on to $2.3, $2.4 billion campaigns, but that's a kind of 20-year advance, and I expect that we will see Canadian universities developing that kind of support because I think there will be an understanding in Canada that our public institutions are precious. It's important to be supported by the taxpayer, but it's also important to be supported by their alumni, by their students and others.
I think we have time to take the questions from those who are at the microphone. So, gentlemen, sir.
Your Excellency, Michael from Montreal and Adam sort of stole my question, but I'm going to put a bit of a gloss on it. You've probably had more experience than anybody that I know in both Canadian university, American universities through yourself and your family. Is it simply a question of money, which is what your last answer would seem to imply, or is there something we can learn from Rutherford's question we've got to think?
Peter, good for you. Money is actually secondary. It's really imagination and determination. Let me illustrate that with just one story. Nathan Pusey was the wonderful president of Harvard in my years there. He came from Appleton College in Wisconsin. He was a scholar of Greek and Latin.
I'll just diverge for a little bit because I love telling these stories. I graduated in 1963, and the greatest protest we had was they were changing our diplomas from Latin into English. And we thought this was a terrible thing to do. So we indignantly requested an urgent meeting with the president to get this situation turned. So within minutes, the reply came back from the president, please meet me for tea in my garden this afternoon. The president's home on campus. So we got our ties on and our jackets on, and over we went and sat down for tea in the garden. And he came out in casual clothes, and he began speaking to us in a tongue we could not understand. And he went on for about 10 minutes in a tongue we could not understand. And then, wonderful teacher that he was, he said, oh, he says, I detect a little lack of comprehension. Don't you realize that was Cicero's speech to the Senate on the importance of tradition and the importance of understanding? Now, I love the tradition of Latin. I teach it. But you don't understand it. When you learn enough Latin that you can read your diplomas in Latin, we'll put them back into Latin. Any event, Dr. Pusey came, and being a good university president, he sat down and set academic objectives and then said, we need $56 million in 1956 to raise this. And he was told by his trusted advisors that it was impossible. You could not raise $56 million. The best you could do was $45 million, and you should not set your target at 56. He said, why not? And they said, well, Harvard cannot fail. He said, let me understand the mathematics. I'm just a poor Latin professor, but if we set a target of $56 million and raised $52 million, that would be a failure. If we set a target of $45 million and raised $46 million, that would be a success. Is that right? He won the argument. $56 million, they raised $65. There we are. So, of course, money is important, but the vision, the determination, the collaboration, Peter, those are the essential things. And any institution, begins with that sense of how do we bring our partners together and cause other people to share the same enthusiasm and passion we have for this and get on with it.
Bonjour, je m'appelle Eloisa Pestigui-Reux. Je viens de finir mes études à McGill. I'm going to ask my question in English because I don't think we have simultaneous translation. My question is with respect to the third pillar you mentioned of charity and volunteerism. I'm wondering, I think that charities are incredibly important. They do amazing work, sometimes very innovative work, and they have an incredibly important role to play in our society, as does volunteerism, because as we know, citizens have responsibilities, and sometimes we forget that. And so I think that that is a very important pillar. Now, what I'm curious about is how you're going to seek to establish this. There is a balance, I think, though, to be had with respect to charity and volunteerism, which is that we also need the state to be making funding choices with taxpayer dollars and somehow counteract perhaps a distortion that can happen with respect to charities, because sometimes when we're speaking of charitable funding, we get distortions, right? We don't have funding where we need it. So how do you think that will play into what you seek to do under that pillar?
Quelle question importante, merci. First of all, can you have a great reinforcement of philanthropy and volunteerism without diminishing the role of the state? That's what we have to sort out. The role of the state is changing as we speak and will change through the 21st century. And we must sort out those responsibilities in a way that doesn't diminish the effort of one versus the other, but sees the two as reinforcing one versus the other. The second thing I would say is that money, as in Peter's question, money is only a part of the philanthropy and volunteerism effort. Let me just say two things about that and then not go on too long, because I go on for a long time. The strategy that we're working at with our colleagues, and we put together an advisory committee on volunteerism and philanthropy, is we would like by 2017 for the notions of philanthropy and volunteerism not to be activities that you kind of turn on or turn off depending upon the circumstance or Salvation Army is calling, but become a mainstream feature of Canadian citizenship. It's something we simply do. Two examples. At the present time, I think Canada is the only jurisdiction in the world where you're not paid to donate blood and you're not charged when you receive blood in the hospital. I think it's the only jurisdiction in the world. If there are others, there are very few. That's quite remarkable and dramatic. On the other hand, on the OECD countries, in terms of donations of organs, especially kidneys, we're down towards the bottom. For some reason, we haven't been able to harness that equally important manifestation of care for our neighbors into mainstream activities. So I'd love to craft the way that we see loving thy neighbor, looking after thy neighbor, as something that's a mainstream feature of Canadian citizenship, not an on and off thing. Let me illustrate that in another way about a story that actually took place in this city. It might have been in this hotel. Mother Teresa was here for the Greater Montreal Prayer Breakfast, and a group of us gathered with her before, 50 people or so, and she gave an inspiring speech. And one of my neighbors said, Mother Teresa, we're so moved by your work. What can we do to be helpful? And I thought, well, she would say, send a check to my refuge in Calcutta. We have a lot of starving people there. What she said was, look around you. Look in your own neighborhood. I guarantee you there's a family in need that needs your love and care. And after her speech, there was a criticism in one of the newspapers that really went this way. Look, she's a wonderful woman. She does great work. But she's in Calcutta, a city of 25 million people, desperately poor. And she looks after 150 people in a shelter. That improves their lives. But what are the other 15 million people in that city and the other many desperate people in that country? Her work is a drop in the bucket. A drop in the bucket. And that kind of festered with me for a period of time until I was at a birthday party. We had a birthday party in our home, the five daughters that Alex referred to. And we finished the party, and the girl sat down and said, Dad, we got something to tell you. You know the ghost stories you tell? Not only are they boring, nobody believes them. They're all false. You make them up. All the kids know that. Would you save our reputation a little bit by either not telling them or doing a better job? Why aren't you like Dean McFarlane? Dean McFarlane really tells great stories at birthday parties. Bloody Annie McFarlane, the dean of journalism at Western. I'm just as good as he is, the competitive instinct. So next month I go to the birthday party at Annie McFarlane's house. Lo and behold, here's Andy dressed like a magician. Big hat, cape, wand, all the stuff. Big, big handlebar mustache. And he's doing magic for the kids. And he says, see this glass that you think is water? It's water. I'm going to turn it into wine. He does the abracadabra, twirls around, etc. I notice, only I watching his sleeve, a little dropper of vegetable dye, red vegetable dye, in the glass of water. Sees the drop in there, suffuses, the whole glass turns a wonderful, wonderful rose, rouge, water into wine. And I thought, Andy, God bless you, you're pretty smart. And I came back to Mother Teresa, and I said, that's interesting. I was looking at the drop in the ocean in a physical way, one drop in a large physical quantity of material water. Why didn't I look at it in a chemical way as changing that water? Because that, in fact, is what that vegetable coloring does. And, of course, that is, I think, what Mother Teresa's example did to the society around. It touched other people. It made us more sensitive to the needs of our neighbors, including the neighbors in our own neighborhood. And I guess that would be our hope for philanthropy and volunteerism. Missy.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Excellency. Unfortunately, I'm not going to have time to get to our last questioner, so I would like to call upon one of our students, Faisal Ghulam Hussain, to do the official thank you to His Excellency.
Merci, Votre Excellence, pour vos remarques aujourd'hui. On est très chanceux pour vous accueillir, comme vous le dites, chez vous, à McGill, et vous êtes toujours le bienvenu. The ideas which you spoke of, compassion, excellence, education, are indeed timeless. Today, my generation is often accused of being politically unaware or politically uninterested. The reality is that ideas like yours are sure to reinvigorate a generation like mine. For the 150th anniversary of Canada, I think we have a similar vision. I think a country that is more compassionate, a country that strives for excellence and educates its people, is undoubtedly a country that can engage its young people. So I guess we have the same vision, that of a better country. On behalf of the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada and McGill University, I'd like to thank you for your remarks here today. Thank you very much.
We will be moving into our next session once the Governor General.